The headlines: the UN Security Council stresses the need to maintain the status quo at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound after an Israeli minister visited the site in occupied Al-Quds. Russia accuses the U.S. of lacking any desire for a political solution to the Ukraine war after Washington downplayed Moscow's truce offer. And the U.S. House of Representatives fail again to elect a speaker as Republicans remain divided on Kevin McCarthy's bid. Welcome. Our top story: the UN Security Council has voiced concern over the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound after a far-right Israeli minister visited the site in occupied Al-Quds earlier this week.
On 3 January, Israel's new Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, conducted a visit accompanied by heavy security detail to the holy site in Jerusalem. The visit was the first to the site by an Israeli minister since 2017. While the visit was not accompanied or followed by violence, it is seen as particularly inflammatory given Mr. Ben-Gvir's past advocacy for changes to the status quo.
Security Council members reaffirmed the need to maintain the status quo at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. They met on Thursday as anger boils among Palestinians over the Israeli minister's visit. They see such visits as provocations aimed at turning the mosque into a Jewish temple. And that's because the decades-old status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound allows only Muslims to worship there. Palestinians want the Security Council to take action.
What red line does Israel need to cross for the Security Council to finally say enough is enough and to act accordingly? When are you going to act? It has displayed utter disregard for the sanctity of Palestinian life, the sanctity of international law, and the sanctity of Al-Haram al-Sharif. It does so with absolute contempt.
The Palestinian envoy also said Israel's actions have nothing to do with religious freedom and aim to change the identity of Al-Aqsa. Israel's envoy to the UN was also present at the Security Council meeting. Gilad Erdan defended the minister's visit to Al-Aqsa, saying it was in line with the status quo. The US, meanwhile, voiced concern over unilateral acts that increase tensions. The Israeli minister's visit sparked anger from other countries, including Muslim nations as well. Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third holiest place in Islam. Meanwhile, Iran has warned against Al-Aqsa Mosque violations by Israeli officials and settlers, saying such moves will have serious consequences for the fake Tel Aviv regime. Foreign Minister Hossein Emir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with the Secretary General of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Hussein Brahim Taha. Iran's top diplomat called for the establishment of a legal international mechanism to stop sacrilegious acts against sacred places and religious sanctities. The OIC chief, for his part, strongly condemned the latest violations of Al-Aqsa Mosque by a right-wing Israeli minister. He said such provocations by Zionists undermine peace and stability in West Asia. Mona Kandil in Ramallah says Al-Aqsa has been at the center of tensions in Palestine in recent years, and any attempt to change the mosque's status quo will explode those tensions.
Palestinians are afraid that condemning, slamming the visit is not enough. What the Palestinians want is action. They want more strict action from the United Nations Security Council. Otherwise, then other Israeli far-right-wing ministers or even any other Israeli official would be raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex with dozens of Israeli settlers, and nothing would go on. The let's say the any infringement of the decades-long status quo at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds definitely would lead to an explosion in the region, not just inside the Palestinian territories, because in the last few years, the main reason for an explosion, or one of the main reasons of the explosion in the region, had been the raids and storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, desecrating it. There could be visits by non-Muslims to tour the area, but not to enter the mosques there, not to perform any rituals or pray. The Israeli settlers want to feel free to enter whenever they want and perform the rituals and to pray there, desecrate the holy site. That has been causing more anger among the Palestinians here.
The first international conference on Marta Soleimani's school of thought has wrapped up in the Iranian capital, Tehran, organized in honor of the assassinated general. The two-day conference shed light on different aspects of his lifestyle and philosophy. Gisu Mishahmadi has more.
Veteran Iranian politicians were present alongside foreign activists, scholars, and researchers on the second and final day of the first international conference on Marta Soleimani's school of thought. Panel discussions shed light on different dimensions of Marta Soleimani's life and legacy.
You have to live with people like Marta Soleimani to understand why they chose that certain lifestyle. Not only that, but even more important is how they choose to die. This makes people like Marta Soleimani stand out.
According to the participants of the conference, Marta Soleimani had a deep understanding of politics and based his views on the guidelines of the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. They say this is the most important reason why he should always be remembered.
It is our national duty to keep the memory of Marta Soleimani alive. He is a role model for future generations, and we need to elaborate on his school of thought for the next generation to walk down the same path.
My husband is in prison in our country, the Republic of Azerbaijan, since 2011, when he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for protesting against the ban on hijab. He was inspired by Marta Soleimani. It is very important to introduce Marta Soleimani to the world and the younger generation.
The plight of the Palestinians was another topic high on the agenda.
This conference is of great importance because one of the major goals of Marta Soleimani was to liberate Palestine, and this is also one of the major issues that was pointed out in the panel discussion. It has also been mentioned in the final statement of the conference.
Eight panels separately focused on different dimensions of Marta Soleimani's school of thought, from his personal life to his teachings and great leadership skills. However, his views regarding international politics received more attention.
I think we can highlight three points. One deals with the role that General Soleimani had in stopping U.S. hegemonic designs for the Middle East. The second point was his ability to organize people, create networks of like-minded people. He was a religious man, he was an ethical man, he was someone that attracted people, and that was one of the reasons that he was successful.
While the organizers of the conference have decided to set up a permanent secretariat, they say they are open to receiving more research papers, projects, and books for the next conference, which will be focusing more on the legacy of a man who is known for making great efforts in eradicating insecurity in the region. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani fought for peace, security, and stability in the region. According to the participants of this conference, his greatest legacy and achievement was eliminating Daesh terrorists. Gisu Mishahmadi, Tehran.
Turning elsewhere now, Russia has lashed out at the United States over its reaction to a 36-hour truce President Vladimir Putin proposed. In Ukraine, U.S. President Joe Biden accused Putin of trying to find some oxygen by ordering the truce from midday on Friday. And that drew criticism from the Russian ambassador to Washington. Anatoly Antonov said Biden's comment means that the U.S. is set on fighting with Russia to the last Ukrainian. The comments, he added, also shows the fate of the Ukrainian people doesn't worry the US at all. Inside Ukraine, the government has also rejected the truce offer. Kiev says there will be no ceasefire until Russian forces withdraw from land they've taken. It also says the offer is a trick to halt the progress of Ukrainian forces in the eastern Donbass region seized by Russia. Earlier researcher Greg Simmons said Russia's, quote, military diplomacy aims to persuade Ukraine into negotiations. So let's take a quick listen to that.
I think this is what you would call euphemistically military diplomacy. So what he is signalling at this point in time, because if you take that with what else he has been saying, that he's open to dialogue about peace on certain terms, this is a form of negotiation to encourage Ukraine to come to peace. But of course, Ukraine is not the one who has the call to make whether to come to peace or not. It's the US which is controlling Ukraine. Although I think that Putin is very well aware of that situation. But this is a form of negotiation in an armed conflict. Zelensky should actually study history and find out what happens to US client states. I mean, it's happened time and time again. As soon as the client state runs out of use, it's cut off. And it will come a point when he's cut off and left to his own devices.
Moving on to the United States now, where the House of Representatives fail for the third time to elect a speaker.
No member-elect, having received a majority of the votes cast, a speaker has not been elected.
The stalemate comes as House Republicans remain divided on Kevin McCarthy's bid. He's the Republican leader at the lower chamber of the U.S. Congress. A group of 20 hardline Republicans are refusing to give him the 218 votes necessary to win the post. They say they don't trust McCarthy to fight for the restrictions they want to impose on President Joe Biden and the Democratic-held Senate. McCarthy has offered concessions to his opponents. To get their votes, the House will now meet again later on Friday to elect a speaker. The stalemate has caused the dysfunction unseen at the House since 1860.
In November 2022, the Republican Party won the majority of votes to the House of Representatives. They vowed to go after Democrats and President Joe Biden, but now cracks have appeared with the party itself. In a historic incident, the GOP failed to nominate the House Speaker. Party leader Kevin McCarthy got just 203 votes in two rounds, less even than Democrat Hakeem Jeffries in the GOP-controlled chamber, and fared even worse, with 202 votes in round three. It went to six rounds, but yet McCarthy could not gain the votes. It was a tumultuous start to the new Congress and pointed to a difficult road ahead with Republicans now in control of the House. A new generation of conservative Republicans, many aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again agenda, want to upend business as usual in Washington and were committed to stopping McCarthy's rise without concessions to their priorities. It is widely believed that a revolt of ultra-hardliners has dealt a humiliation to McCarthy.
Those of us who will not be voting for Kevin McCarthy today take no joy in this discomfort that this moment has brought. But if you want to drain the swamp, you cannot put the biggest alligator in charge of the exercise.
McCarthy became the first candidate to fall short in a first ballot for speaker in a century. The impasse means Republicans are unable even to assume the control that they won in the midterms, as a new House can't yet be sworn in. The standoff over McCarthy has been building since Republicans appeared on track to win the House majority in the midterm elections in November. A new generation of Trump-aligned Republicans led the opposition to McCarthy, believing that he's neither conservative enough nor tough enough to battle Democrats.
And they even came to the position where one, Matt Gaetz, said, I don't care if we go to plurality and we elect Hakeem Jeffries and it hurts the new frontline members not to get reelected. Well, that's not about America, and I will always fight to put the American people first, not a few individuals that want something for themselves. So we may have a battle on the floor, but the battle is for the conference and the country, and that's fine with me.
While the standoff risks paralyzing the House and forcing the lawmakers to consider another candidate. Republicans flipped the House in their favor with a narrow majority in the 2020 midterm elections. But there are now concerns that the fractures could deal a severe blow to the GOP in Congress and the next presidential election.
While the Senate remains in Democratic hands, House Republicans are eager to confront Biden after 2 years of the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress. But disagreements to choose the House Speaker is an ominous sign for the party and its conservative agenda. Even if McCarthy succeeds to be the Speaker, he will be a weak figure who may be in office but barely in power. The war, which started with the Tea Party backlash to the Obama administration, is far from over.
We will compromise, but we will not capitulate. And there's a very serious difference. There's 222 Republicans in our conference now. So if 20 people are able to drive this train however they want to, 202 of us might as well go home, because that means they are the conference. That means they those 20 people will be the majority. Well, that is capitulation, and we will not do that. Compromise, yes.
The fractured support for McCarthy is over the direction of the GOP between swing district moderates and conservatives who have taken up the populist agenda of the former President Donald Trump. It is now believed that the chaos highlights the dilemma facing House Republicans. Analysts say no matter the concessions made to some of those on the far right, they simply will not relent and join other Republicans.
That wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. The first point is with regards to the document on fundamental transformation that he, Mr. Mohsen Ejaei, the head of the judiciary, talked about. This document on transformation is one of the most progressive documents for change. First, it was prepared. Later, it was revised during the time of Mr. Raisi. Important points were added, and it was completed in that revision. So this document should be acted upon. The esteemed head of the judiciary is committed, and he follows up on things. But matters must be followed up on at different levels. Judges, staff, and managers must follow up on matters too. But based on the reports that I have received, some are not doing completely the things that one thinks should be done in this area. According to this document, a workforce should be trained. As has been frequently said, personnel need to be trained.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Action should be taken in accordance with this document. That is, the judiciary must not be passive in the face of rumors, talk, opposition to it, and the like. There is a straight path in front of it, and it should follow and move along this path with strength. The judiciary should not be influenced by rumors, whether some people like what it has done and some people dislike it. This is the first recommendation. My second recommendation is that the issue of fighting corruption should be taken seriously. Corruption exists. Mr. Mohseni Ejei told me something good in one of these recent meetings. He said apparently this is what he meant, that they had decided to first fight corruption within the judiciary itself. Yes, that's a good action to take. It is not true to say that no corruption exists within the judiciary. Of course, the majority of judges are honest, noble, faithful, hardworking, and truly honorable people. But if there are 10 bad people in a group of 1,000 people, they can harm the rest of the group in terms of their reputation, in terms of work and the like. You have to look for these 10 bad people. However, the main task is to confront the structures that bring corruption.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Right here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Now, former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright once said, if we have to use force, it is because we are America. We are the indispensable nation. We stand tall and we see further than other countries into the future, and we see the danger here to us all. Now, if you look up the word indispensable in Webster's dictionary, it is defined as absolutely necessary. So she believes, and still some people do, that America is absolutely necessary. It is standing tall, as she said. But the real question is, does America really stand tall today? Is it absolutely necessary? And to discuss that question, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show, Abiyomi Ezekiwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire, joining us from Detroit, Michigan, and Sarah Flounders, co-director at the International Action Center, joining us from New York. Stay tuned.
The narratives of American decline have become so prevalent that even the U.S. officials, who publicly at least don't acknowledge it, usually make arguments about it. They don't claim that America is the only leader, as U.S. officials used to say. They usually go like, it's true that we have had some setbacks, but we can overcome and be a rising superpower again. Such assertions tacitly acknowledge that they know America is a power in decline.
Now, on an international level, the idea of American decline is usually intertwined with a rising China, which is rapidly closing the gap on the U.S. on the economic and military fronts. So do you think China is perhaps the number one challenge for U.S. supremacy?
It's definitely correct because the United States publicly, through the State Department, and other sources have declared that China is the number one strategic competitor of the United States. And that's a diplomatic way of saying that they are adversaries. And we can see that clearly in all the foreign policy initiatives related to China, the challenge to the One China policy, the visit by the outgoing House of Representatives, Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, to Taiwan. These are all indications of the hostility of the United States towards China.
Now, of course, China's versions of world order, something which is usually referred to as the China model, is different from that of the United States. So how would you compare these two superpowers and their respective world orders?
Well, China is absolutely a rising economic power, and it offers something very positive to all the countries of the world. It's impossible to underestimate the impact of the Belt and Road Program with 149 countries, trillions of dollars for infrastructure. U.S. aid is military aid. It's selling weapons. It's interest in war and creating differences among countries. Whereas China is both a rising economic power, able to feed and care for its own people, but also able to help other countries provide for their population, to build infrastructure, to improve grain production, to improve industries. That is really a big difference. And it's a big threat to the United States corporate economy, because these are the very things that they can't offer and that they don't offer to any country in the world.
On the military front, the U.S. is said to have spent $7 trillion in West Asia as part of its wars on Iraq, Afghanistan, and military presence in other countries. Was that a sum of money well spent?
I think it's outrageous that type of money is being spent on military bases, on surveillance, on military interventions and occupations and destabilization of various countries throughout the world, when, in fact, inside the United States, you still have huge numbers of people who live in poverty, and you still have major social problems that are not being addressed. So this is a complete waste, but it's reflective of the desperate conditions that the United States ruling class finds itself in competition with other countries, including China, as you mentioned before.
Those who believe that the United States is an indispensable nation usually point to its military prowess. More than any other country, the United States retains a far greater capacity to send troops or bombs to various locations across the world in a short time frame. The U.S. has been constantly at war with other nations. How this military agenda can be rated, and is the U.S. military power also diminishing?
I think U.S. military power is absolutely in decline. There's been one war after another, and in not one of these wars has the U.S. Gained the aims, the reason for the war. Each war has been, for them, a complete political setback. And it's wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, also in Syria, in Libya, in Yemen. Every war actually has built greater resistance and finally a new cohesion among the population. That's a shock to the U.S. Because the military strategists assume that their military power is so great that they could overwhelm opposition. And yet they were defeated in Afghanistan, a country that ranks among the very poorest in the world.
Unmatched global military capabilities provide U.S. officials with an unmatched spectrum of policy options. America invaded Afghanistan 20 years ago to topple the Taliban, but gave the country back to the same group and left it last year in a rush. Successive governments' foreign policies on Afghanistan have been described as a failure and miscalculated. So how do you rate U.S. overall foreign policy, and was Afghanistan just an exception?
It is not an isolated incident. What happened in Afghanistan, we saw the same failure in Vietnam, North Korea in the 1950s, Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s. We saw the same failure in Southern Africa during the 1970s, 80s, and early 90s. So it is a pattern of the United States siding with the interests of reaction as opposed to siding with the proper interests of the people in these countries throughout the world.
They literally left Afghanistan in complete defeat. The government they spent 20 years creating collapsed. The bases were of no use to them. So this is something that people around the world are watching. They have failed to secure their domination in the region. Afghanistan was to be their crucial link in Central Asia, just as Iraq and then Syria was to give them control in West Asia. It did not succeed. Libya, they completely ruined a country that was the richest country of Africa, and yet they did not secure a stable and new base. Even in Libya, they brought complete ruin to the country, but they didn't secure their military and political objective.
The United States has committed almost $60 billion in military aid to Ukraine. That dwarfs any other U.S. foreign military assistance in 1 year since the Vietnam War. Washington says the aid is necessary to help Ukraine keep fighting, but many have said it only prolongs the war.
Well, they have, in fact, indicated that they are running out of ammunition and spare parts. A lot of the weapons that have been sent to assist the Ukrainian government in their fight against the Russian Federation have been sold in the informal economy. At least one leader in Africa has reported that weapons that have been sent to Ukraine have wound up in the hands of extremists and criminals in his country. So this is a desperate attempt by the United States to stave off a further military defeat. But I do not believe that the U.S. will prevail in Ukraine because the people in this country will not listen to the continuing lies from the Biden administration and eventually will turn against Biden's policy in Eastern Europe.
On the domestic front, widespread violence, mass food insecurity, a chronic homelessness headache, drug problems, and increasing hostilities in domestic politics. So many things bad with America. Francis Fukuyama says the United States' political decay has continued at a startling pace, and the system is still too rigid to reform itself.
Yes, a clear indication of this is the failure to reform the security apparatus of the United States. As we remember, just 2.5 years ago, there were literally millions of people demonstrating throughout the United States and the world in response to the death at the hands of the police of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And since that time period, there's been stiff resistance to reform inside the police department. In fact, they've thrown more money at law enforcement over the last 2.5 years as opposed to trying to address underlying social conditions. And I think this is also true in regard to the economy. The United States working class and people who live in poverty are being destroyed right now as a result of inflation. And instead of imposing price controls and other social welfare measures, the president is only allowing the Federal Reserve Bank to raise interest rates, which is causing more unemployment and more economic hardships.
Could the U.S. tackle the underlying problems of its political system by launching some reforms? Is there any change in that regard in the foreseeable future?
Now, I have no idea what reform of this system would mean, because the U.S. empire is built from its very founding on the slave trade, African slaves, on the genocide of the indigenous population of the U.S. It was always... It's not that it ever had a perfect day. It did not. And so I don't know what reforming it would mean. It needs a drastic change in its entire direction. And any of the political forces in office at this time is incapable of making that change.
Now, former U.S. President Donald Trump has recently said that the U.S. Constitution should be terminated. Is the rise of people like Donald Trump to power in America a sign of U.S. decline?
Most definitely. His election in 2016 was clearly a representation of the decline of the United States. The fact that he even became the nominee in 2016, someone who had no political experience, who had never held office previously, who was clearly found very offensive by millions, tens of millions of people inside the United States. The fact that he even became the nominee and the president was clearly an indication of the failure of the United States political culture. And with him saying that the Constitution should be suspended, he attempted to do that 2 years ago when he failed to win re-election in 2020. And he attempted, through the destruction of the Postal Service and through lies claiming that the election had been stolen, and attempts to stage a coup d'etat on January 6th of 2021, shows that he has no respect for democratic culture.
And then there is Donald Trump's successor. President Joe Biden has been filmed shaking hands with ghosts, speaking to people who are not there, and at times saying things that no one has any idea what they mean.
People who want a change, who want to somehow oppose what they could see from the Democrats, where can they look? For something that's worse, where there's big promises, and yet none of them happen? So to say end the Constitution, what is that really saying? It's saying, let's do away with the few protections that barely still exist within the Constitution, within the U.S. Bill of Rights, within the right to assemble and even state a political opposition. This is what the Trump forces want to do away with. It's also an appeal to racism, quite frankly, and it's an appeal against women and their rights. So I think it's a very dangerous thing, but the problem really exists in that the Democrats and the Biden forces don't provide any alternative.
Many, of course, reject the idea of American decline, saying, for example, U.S. military power remains preeminent. It is geographically situated between two oceans and has no competitor around itself, etc. They say the U.S. will regain its lost power. What are the odds of the United States regaining its lost power and being a rising superpower again?
I think the odds are very slim. If we look at history, over the last 50, 60 years, the U.S. has failed on numerous occasions. I mentioned Vietnam throughout the entire region of Southeast Asia, on the Korean Peninsula, where they attempted to overthrow the government in North Korea, and they were defeated. They've been doing everything in their power to destroy the People's Republic of China. It is still strong. Same situation with the Islamic Republic of Iran, Cuba. They've attempted to destroy all these countries, and they have not been successful. More and more people now are turning towards anti-imperialism. They're turning toward revolutionary policies, and this is a clear threat to U.S. hegemony.
Well, I don't think that's at all in the cards. I don't think that here's the real problem. What does U.S. imperialism have to offer the people of the world? In trade, they can sell weapons. They don't sell much else. They have no interest in dealing with the very real problems of climate, of food, of the needs of people around the world. And every country knows that. And they also know that there are alternatives now. their alternatives in countries cooperating with each other and cooperating against dollar dominance. There's new currency exchanges that are developing. The U.S. can't stop that, can't save their dollar from slipping.
Looking at the U.S. foreign policy in the last years, one can really see the changes to tackle rising China in an attempt to stop the American decline. The signs are all there. The U.S. backpacked from West Asia to focus attention on South China Sea and the balance of the coalition that is forming in that region. The Nancy Pelosi's explosive visit to Taiwan and the trade war with China.
But it seems as if American politicians are just dealing with the problem of decline on the international level, you know, military power, China, Russia, and Iran. But decline is not just about the outside. What about the problems at home, like homelessness, food insecurity, drug crimes and gun crimes, immigrants, high suicide rates, people doing multiple jobs, you name it. Decline could be very invisible from the inside. And now let's see what Abbas Montaghim has prepared for us this week.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's episode, we is going to take a look at some of the recent developments of the American Empire and look at the current state of American imperialism in the world. To start off, it's no secret that today, the USA isn't the only power in this world. And this has resulted in the creation of a multipolar world. And with this new world development, some people have claimed that American imperialism itself is a dying order. But does this statement, does it have any truth? Well, it's important to know, it's important that we understand that American imperialism itself is always in a constant state of change, expansion, and growth. So even when it takes a loss in one area of the world, it's going to attempt to expand in another area, which means it's not dying, rather it's just multiplying somewhere else. American imperialism, it's like an octopus. You cut off one tentacle and another one is gonna grow. And an example of this is how the USA, they left Afghanistan after decades of a genocidal war and then immediately began this proxy war against Russia and the conflict in Ukraine, in which the USA has supported Ukraine by sending billions upon billions of dollars in military support and aid. This has allowed American corporations and the weapons and oil industry to make billions, billions in profits, because that's what American war is for. It's for money and to loot the natural resources of the world. Not only that, but the USA, they have also deployed special operations troops in Sudan just shortly after taking troops away from Afghanistan. And it's becoming clearer and clearer that the USA is trying to advance its neocolonial occupation of Africa to an even higher stage. All this is to make up for profit losses in countries that the USA quote-unquote left. This is evident through the newly announced USA-Africa partnership. This partnership, it can be essentially described as the second scramble for the neo-colonial occupation and control of Africa and its resources. One part of this new partnership, it involves both Zambia and the DRC signing deals, essentially giving the green light for America and its corporations to control the production of cobalt and copper. And this is no small development, as the DRC, they provide 70% of the world's cobalt, while Zambia is Africa's second largest cobalt producer. This is making the way for the United States to control the resources for batteries for electric vehicle production, and it will use exploited African slave labor to do so. Also, first world nations can have their so-called environmentally friendly green cars. It's clear as day that this U.S.-Africa partnership is just a guise for America and its corporations to further loot Africa of her resources. Also, that America can continue to be the blood-sucking parasite that it is, as these Americans are entrapping African countries into further cycles of debt so that America can control its economy. This is why we can't say that American imperialism is a dying order, because it's very clear that when America, it takes losses in other nations, the USA, they will increase its expansion and neo-colonial efforts in other nations. American imperialism, it will not end itself. It has to completely be destroyed and brought to an end. The world can never truly be free if the USA and its imperialist expansion is allowed to exist. This imperialist machine, it must be destroyed for the world to have an opportunity for peace. This is Power to the People.
Well, that was our show, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do check in next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the Redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. Well, everyone wants to know when Imam is going to come. But for that, we have some signs. Some of the signs are definite signs and some are indefinite. And among the signs, one of the things that is described is the advent of Sufyani. Who is he? Is that a sign of a definite one or an uncertain sign? We'll talk about that with Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome, sir.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
First of all, let's just, since we are going to talk about we're just going to open up this topic of Sufyani. I would want to ask you, for our audiences, please tell the importance, like, why is it important? What is the importance of, like, describing this Sufyani?
Having talked about Yamani as one of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, now we would like to talk about the second sign. We said that according to many narrations, there are five signs which are described as the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yeah.
Based on the narrations, it seems that this sign, that he is Sufyani, is, based on the number of the narrations that we have about him, has a special position in terms of the importance as one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And the Shia scholars believe that the number of the narrations about Sufyani is so many that we can claim that they are mutawatir, meaning that they are widely transmitted.
All right.
And when it comes to Shia sources, there are narrations in great Shia sources of hadith like Al-Kafi, Qurb al-Isnad, Kamaluddin, Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, and Al-Ghiba by Sheikh al-Tusi. And of course, some of the Sunni scholars also have talked about him too. So there are some questions about him. Who is Sufyani? What is his lineage? And what is the time for his reappearance and the place of it? What are his goals? The course of his movements? That, inshallah, we'll talk about that in a series of discussions.
Yeah.
Now, regarding the reasons and the necessity of talking about him, the significance of Sufyani, there are a couple of points. One of them is that, as I mentioned, Sufyani is for sure one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. The second point is that, based on the narrations that, inshallah, we'll talk about them later, one of the main goals of the movement of Sufyani is to attack the Shia regions of the world and to massacre the Shia. And that is why, as Shia, it is important for us to know him, to know different dimensions of his movement and his uprising. As I mentioned, his main goal is just to, remove the Shia school of thought and to massacre the Shia.
Okay.
The third point about him, which makes it a very significant topic as one of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, is that the dimensions of this sign compared to other signs are very vast.
Okay.
For example, in one of the other signs is Nafs-e Zakiya. We are talking about one person or the heavenly cry or Khasf-e Bayda, the fact that the army of Sufyani would be swallowed up. All of them are limited in, a short time and in a certain place. But the uprising of Sufyani is not limited at all. And we can come to this conclusion that it has some effects on, the events for the whole world and at least for the Islamic world. So, and one of the reasons is that his uprising is, a clear opposition to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and his reappearance.
Yeah.
This is another point regarding this sign, the Sufyani.
All right. We'll talk about more necessities after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us. Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We have Dr. Karimi. And Dr. Karimi, you were talking about the necessity of knowing about Sufyani.
Yeah, I shared 3 points. And maybe it is because of these 3 points that we see that the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, and of course the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, they have also paid a special attention to this sign, that is Sufyani. Interestingly, regarding Sufyani, we have narrations from the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, Imam al-Rida alayhi salam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, and Imam Mahdi himself.
All right.
May Allah hasten his reappearance. And all together, we have about 100 narrations regarding Sufyani. And this is another indication regarding the significance of this sign. And when it comes to the book of Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, which is one of the most authentic sources about Mahdawiyya and Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, In his book, he has dedicated one independent chapter for Sofiani.
All right.
So all these points make it very clear that we are talking about a very important sign, as one of the different signs for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, that is for the reappearance of the Imam. And that is why we try to talk about this sign in more details, inshallah.
All right. So we have a couple of reasons that we are talking about this sign in detail. Knowing about the necessity of this sign is that, firstly, it's a definite sign. It's considered as one of the certain signs of reappearance. And it has been described that he's going to carry out Shia genocide or he's going to attack Shia areas. So it becomes necessary for Shias to know the enemy, or you said there are vast dimensions of this sign, and there are more than some 100 narrations from Prophet himself and from other imams as well. When we actually talk about this sign, there's again a question which arises in the minds, is that, is it a one person? Is it a sign? Is it a moment? Is it a reality? What is it?
Yeah, that's a very important topic, about not only about Sofiani, but also about the other signs, which are some of the other signs which are mentioned about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. There are two questions. First of all, is Sofiani a reality or just a symbol?
Yeah.
And second of all, if he's a reality, is it referring to one person or there might be a couple of people with the same name?
Yeah, is it a moment or so?
Exactly. Yeah. So first of all, we need to answer this question. Is Sofiani just
a symbol or
a reality? I mean, that is, we have a person named Sofiani.
Yeah.
If we mention about some of the other signs, for example, when it comes to Dajjal, of course, Dajjal is mentioned mainly in Sunni sources. There are discussions whether Dajjal is a name of a person or it's just, a symbol of, for example, according to some people, it might refer to, social media, for example, which may deviate the people. So
yeah.
This word Dajjal, as mentioned in the narration, is not referring to a reality. Rather, in a symbolic way, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt have introduced Dajjal as, for example, movement, as something which would deviate the people. So this is the question about some of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, whether they are symbolic or they are referring to the realities.
Yeah.
The same has been mentioned about Sofiani. The question is that the Sofiani, as mentioned in the narration, is it symbolic? If we claim that it is symbolic, again, we may claim that it is referring to a movement, for example.
Yeah.
Or no, Sofiani in the narrations is referring to a certain person with the name or at least title of Sofiani. So this is a very important question. So there are two theories here. The first theory is that Sofiani is symbolic, meaning that, for example, it is referring to an intellectual or cultural movement opposing the doctrines of Mahdawiya. So it's not referring to one person. Or, for example, it can refer to the same has been mentioned about Dajjal for some people, that is referring to material civilization. It's not a person. So we have this viewpoint about Sofiani too.
All right. So we'll talk more on that after a short break.
Sure.
Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior with Dr. Karimi. And Dr. Karimi, we're discussing with you, is Sofiani a symbol or a reality? Well, you said we had two theories which would answer the question.
Yeah, as I mentioned, of course, Sufyani is one of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. There is no doubt about that. But yeah. Now the question is that Sufyani in the narration is referring to one person, or is it symbolic and it may refer to a movement, for example? Some people have claimed that Sufyani is not referring to a certain person, rather, I mean, this thing.